Hello, folks. I'd like to welcome you to Labor Relations Information Systems First Thursday podcast for December 2015. My name is Will Aitchison. Over the course of the next 45 minutes or so, I'm going to review developments in the public safety workplace, labor relations, and other issues. And I'm going to start by actually talking about other issues. I want to talk about what's going on nationally with respect to the way police unions are viewed. I've mentioned a few things about this over the course of the last year, but the drums are beating fairly loudly right now. We are seeing groups on both ends of the political spectrum, the left and the right, advocating for restrictions in the rights of police unions. In some cases, groups, these tend to be more the ones on the right-wing side of the ledger, are outright advocating for the repeal of collective bargaining laws. Over on the left, there's more of a laser-like focus on getting rid of contract clauses that police unions for many years have thought necessary to ensure that discipline is imposed in a fair way. What you see now, though, is that these groups are starting to get their voices heard. This was drawn home to me when I was looking at an article this week in something called The New Republican. That's a magazine. That's one that's on the left-hand side of the political spectrum. And The New Republic, the theme of the entire article was, if we want racial justice in this country, we need to start by getting rid of police unions. And of course, that's something that has been advocated over on the right side of the table for a long time. What I want to do in this podcast is to more specifically illustrate for you some of these approaches that are being taken out there. And I want to end this portion of the podcast with a challenge to those in the police union movement. And not just police unions, but everybody in the public safety union movement. Because what happens if a piece of hide is taken out of the side of police unions? Well, firefighter unions, corrections unions, they're going to be next. It's pretty easy to predict that. So let's look at, I want to focus on, I think I'm going to talk mostly about four different web pages that are out there. That to me illustrate these attacks on kind of the fundamentals of the police union movement. And I'll start with the simplest of the web pages. And this has been around over a year now. This is from the American Civil Liberties Union. The ACLU, I'm sure everybody knows what the ACLU is. It is essentially a legal advocacy group that largely is, if we are sticking with this political spectrum thing, largely represents interests on the left side of the spectrum, although you do find them on the far right from time to time as well. What the ACLU has is something they call a mobile justice webpage. More to the point, it's a mobile justice app. And what it is something where if you have a cell phone, you can download this app. And by the way, we'll put links to all of these things on our webpage for you so you can check them out. You can download this app, and that will allow you, when you're at the scene of some sort of police action or another, if you are a citizen, that will allow you to take your cell phone out, record it. There'll be a handy-dandy button where you can upload it to the ACLU, which will then peruse it for issues of police misconduct. The whole idea being that police officers are not policing themselves, and therefore citizens need to step in and help that effort. That mobile justice app is now available in 18 states. And they're starting to expand. They now have an app. This one's only available in New Jersey that they call a stop and frisk app. Now, a different kind of web page, and this is from the far right-hand side of the political ledger, and this is from the Cato Institute. And this is a right-wing think tank. If you're unfamiliar with the Cato Institute, they've been around for an awful long time. They'll provide talking heads for Fox News when they need them on any policy issue, you know, from the Mideast to why the president is a bad human being or whatever it might be. The Cato Institute, which is partially funded by the Koch brothers, has had a focus on public sector collective bargaining for some time now. They want to do away with it. They want to turn the entire country into a right-to-work country and have no police, fire, or any public unions. They don't like teacher unions in particular. But now, they, like the ACLU, they are focusing on what they see to be police misconduct. And they have a webpage that's called the National Police Misconduct Reporting Project. And what this webpage does is, it's kind of I think of it as a news aggregator. They've clearly got some sort of search engine strings that they've saved out there. They're running them through some news trawler, maybe Google News or Yahoo News or, you know, whatever it might be. And then once a week, they will post all the articles from around the country that they believe, they meaning the Cato Institute, believe fall under the heading of police misconduct. And the idea being, I think, that you can go to the Cato Institute's webpage and look at these articles and say, God, how terrible our police officers are. When you look at the, sorry about that ring, by the way, I usually remember to unplug things, won't happen again. When you look at what the Cato Institute has collected and what they call misconduct, it's a strange range of things. So, for example, I'm looking at the reports of misconduct through November 30, the week that ended November 30, 2015. They include as misconduct an officer who was arrested for domestic violence, went to a trial, and a judge found that he was not guilty. They say that is misconduct. And the whole idea behind this is that because police officers are so rampantly committing misconduct, what we need to do is we need to get rid of the organizations that defend them. And that would be police unions. So there we have something on the left, and we have something on the right. Now let's go back to the left. I've got two more examples for you. Let's go back to the left, and an outfit that is doing a couple of things right now. This is an outfit called Campaign Zero. Campaign Zero is an organization that seems focused on racial justice. Increasingly, they are focused on police. They have just released, this is in the last week or so, something they call the Police Union Contract Project. I can read you the subheading of this webpage. You can go there to, and I'm quoting, learn how police union contracts make it more difficult to hold police officers accountable for misconduct. What they've done is to put together, it looks like about 15 or 20 police contracts from around the country, and they have a little matrix, a little kind of baby matrix as to that shows you whether or not these contracts have provisions that they, Campaign Zero, deem inappropriate. So the contract clauses might involve civilian oversight or purging materials from personnel files and that sort of thing. They claim this is the first police contract database in the country, which is kind of a joke. I mean, there have been lots of people collecting police contracts for a long time. You can go to our webpage, LRIS. You've been able to do it for years and download not just 14 contracts, but a whole lot more than 14 contracts. And their whole approach, I would say, is a little bit amateurish. But nonetheless, they are putting a fair amount of work in it. What are they after? What do they want? Well, you can go to a separate webpage they have, one that's called Fair Police Contracts, and you can see a list of what they want. And they want these provisions removed, both from collective bargaining agreements and from law enforcement peace officer Bill of Rights. They want these sorts of clauses removed. Clauses that allow officers to wait 48 hours or more before being interrogated after a deadly force incident. Apparently, they want the repeal of the Fifth Amendment as well, but they don't seem to have thought that one through too much. They want to remove contract clauses that prevent an officer's name or picture from being released to the public. They want civilians to be able to have the power to discipline, subpoena, and interrogate police officers. They want to eliminate contract clauses that say that the chief has the sole authority to discipline police officers. They, of course, want to eliminate the right to appeal disciplinary decisions. They want to eliminate bans on polygraph examinations. They want to get rid of the purging of stale disciplinary materials from police officers' files, and they want to make sure that officers who've been involved in critical incidents don't get put on paid leave. They apparently think that they should be suspended without pay or sent right back to the street or I don't know what. They, like I said, this is kind of amateurish, and they clearly haven't thought this thing through, but nonetheless, they're putting a lot of effort into it. Now let me move on to my fourth web page, and then I'm going to make the point that I'm going on and on and on in order to make. The fourth web page actually isn't a web page; it's a news story, and the news story is about a presidential candidate who has suddenly made police benefits part of his campaign. Who is the presidential candidate who has done that? New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. If you follow the Republican primaries and the lead up to the Republican primaries and caucuses, you probably know that Christie is somewhere in the second tier of candidates. He's not thought of as being the top four. As I speak, the top four right now would be Donald Trump and Ben Carson and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz would be those four, although that can, as we've seen, that can change in a week. So Christie is somewhere behind all of them. Christie is focusing a lot of his campaign up in New Hampshire, and he just received the endorsement of the largest newspaper in New Hampshire, one that has had a fair amount of influence over the Republican presidential primary over the years. And right after he released the received that endorsement, Christie was asked in a press conference about somebody back in New Jersey. And who is the someone back in New Jersey? It's the president of the PBA, a fellow named Pat Colligan. Pat Colligan is, I guess, just became president of the PBA, which is the statewide organization there, last year. He's been a full-time police officer for 25 years. I guess he's been on union duty for a year now. And Colligan, when he saw that Christie had received the endorsement of the newspaper up in New Hampshire, Colligan was critical of that, and Christie responded. How did Christie respond? He responded in a personal way. He said of Colligan, and I'm quoting, "It's because he's a pension pig. That's why. That's what it's all about, and you know that. He's a pension pig. That's what he's always been. It's about feeding at the trough as much as he possibly can. That's what they've always been about. Rank-and-file law enforcement men and women have voted for me in overwhelming numbers in my elections in New Jersey, and they'll vote for me again as governor, because they know that I stand up for them." Colligan, of course, has a bit of a response to that. This is New Jersey politics right at its most basic level here. Colligan says, "The Chris Christie that people in New Hampshire saw today is the same one our members have been dealing with for the last 6 years. This is a man who has proven time and time again he will say and do whatever it takes to claw to the next political position. 6 years ago, in his first campaign for governor, he sent a letter to rank-and-file officers promising that he would never harm their pensions. That was a lie." And Colligan goes on and on and on. So, why am I tying all these four things together? One, the ACLU's webpage that has been around for a bit, the Cato Institute, which has for a long time been attacking police unions and simply seems to have stepped up the rhetoric, and now these two more recent things, the police contract database and Chris Christie taking on police unions. The reason I'm talking about this is that I really think police unions need to fundamentally change the way they are communicating about their mission. They need to change the way they communicate to the public. They need to change the way they communicate to their own members. They need to change the way they communicate to the media and the way they communicate to politicians. Because right now, what's going on, this standard tried and true method that we have seen, that we still see anytime there's an allegation of police misconduct that strikes at the national court, right now that method of communicating isn't working. We are coming up on January. And with January, we'll see the start of legislative sessions around the country. You can bet that there are going to be bills that are going to be sponsored in every state with statewide collective bargaining for police and fire unions. You're going to see bills that either eliminate collective bargaining or get at these core disciplinary issues that you see the left and the right kind of coalescing around. Police unions need to be ready to deal with that. They need to better explain why it is, for example, an officer who has been involved in a shooting should be placed on paid leave. Why it is that officer shouldn't be put back out on the street or be given an unpaid leave of absence so that their families are penalized for something that the officer had absolutely no influence over at all. Why it is that it is important that there are bills of rights, that discipline be handed out in a procedurally correct manner. How it is we can't hire people to be police officers in this country. I think in large part because of this focus, this incredible emphasis on how bad police officers are. A completely false emphasis, but it is one that drives people away from the career of policing. Police unions need to be emphasizing this stuff. They need to be standing up and saying, we don't want special rights. We want the right to be treated fairly. You know, if somebody that we arrest has the right to be free from compulsory self-incrimination, and they have the right to say, no, I'm not going to give a statement, then when we are involved in a critical incident, we are the subject of a homicide investigation, we should have that same right. Why not? Police unions need to come together. They need to talk about this whole issue of communication. They need to study how it is corporations that have been facing much worse communication problems, how it is they have dealt with that. They have turned things around. They have managed to get the public on their side. We need to learn new lessons, and we need to bring about a different result. Otherwise, I'm afraid the end that I am seeing here, which will be a modification, if not an elimination, of collective bargaining laws, I'm afraid that end is going to be more and more of a realistic possibility. Okay, I'm off my soapbox now. Let me turn to something I'm probably, hopefully, better at, and that is reading some cases. I want to talk about an issue that's floating around, been floating around for, I've seen these things the last 15 years or so. These are requirements that public safety employees, and they're both police and fire, repay their employer the costs of training if they leave within the first number of years of service and go to work for another employer. And where you see this is you see this in areas where you've got a lot of agencies that are chasing after a limited labor pool. And consequently, you see it all over the place with policing right now. And you find these police agencies that get very tired of young men and women hiring on, training them, And estimates are that it costs anywhere from $100,000 to $200,000 to train a police officer. These agencies will spend that much money only to see 3 years later that officer move someplace else and go to greener pastures. And then the agency is out the training money, and the officer has gained from the experience, made themselves more marketable, has gone someplace else where probably they're paying higher wages and benefits or have better working conditions. So that's the problem that these agencies have faced. And one of the ways that they have tried to deal with the problem, and it's just one of them, there's other ways, but one of the ways is by having applicants, when they hire on, sign a document. And the document says, look, I know you're going to spend a lot of money training me. I agree that if I leave within the first, usually it's five years of employment, and I go to work for another public safety agency, I will repay whatever it is you expended to train me. Now, sometimes it's prorated. So if you stay 5 years, you only have to repay 20%. You stay 4 years, you have to repay 40%, whatever it might be. Sometimes it's not a complete repayment of the cost. Sometimes the amount of costs associated with training is specified. Sometimes it's a repayment of wages. These things take a lot of different forms. But they're in fairly widespread use, particularly in major metropolitan areas. And the question is, are they legal? And I unfortunately have to give you a four-part answer to that. Used to be I would give a three-part answer, but we have this new case out of the California Court of Appeals that makes it a four-part answer now. So first of all, I would say in a non-union environment, so where there's no collective bargaining rights, there's a case out of Mississippi that says this, for example, no collective bargaining rights, no union on the scene, these types of clauses are legal. And they've been challenged in a variety of ways. They've been challenged constitutionally that they violate due process, that they violate what's known as the constitutional right to travel. And all of those challenges, to the best of my knowledge, have failed. So that's part one of my answer. And I end part one of my answer with the word but and an ellipsis. Because part two, if that repayment of training costs requirement, when it's actually implemented, so when the firefighter or the officer leaves and has to repay the training costs, if that takes them below the minimum wage for the time period they worked for the employer, then the clause would violate the Fair Labor Standards Act. Because under the FLSA, you can never go below the minimum wage. So another way of phrasing part two is, even in a non-union environment, if the repayment of training costs requirement is in place, it can only apply to take the officer down to the minimum wage over the time period the officer or firefighter worked for the department. Which takes us to part three. Because parts one and two deal with a non-union environment. Part three deals with a union environment. Of course, the FLSA's rules would apply in a union environment as well. But there's something else in a union environment. These clauses, repayment of training costs requirements, these clauses have been held by labor boards around the country to be what are known as mandatory subjects of bargaining. A mandatory subject of bargaining, loosely speaking, a wage, hour, or working condition, these are the things over which both a union and an employer must negotiate if either side brings it up. And why is a repayment of training costs requirement thought to be a mandatory subject of bargaining? Because it impacts wages, right? When it's implemented, when it's applied, then when the firefighter or the officer wants to leave, then it's going to have an impact on their compensation, which would, of course, be a mandatory subject of bargaining. Where the litigation has really been here in a collective bargaining environment is with employers who have I think, a pretty creative defense. They say, look, maybe a mandatory subject to bargaining may impact wages, but we entered into that contract with this person before they were an employee. They signed it as a condition of getting the job. And before they were an employee, the union had no right to represent them. And therefore, we could enter into the agreement with them. Well, what's that defense getting at? The defense is getting at this interesting rule of collective bargaining, that if something is a mandatory subject of bargaining, the agreement has to be with the union. An employer can't go out there and reach one-on-one agreements with members of the bargaining unit about mandatory subjects of bargaining. That's thought to undercut the union's status as the exclusive representatives of employees. These are called, this goes back to the 1930s in the private sector, these are called yellow dog contracts. And they're illegal because they impact the union's ability to bargain. I mean, obviously, if an employer could go out there and cut one-on-one deals with members of the bargaining unit, why would anybody even want to be involved in a union? So what this defense is that the employers are saying, look, we recognize it's a mandatory subject to bargaining. We recognize that we have to, this deal on repayment of training costs would normally have to be with the union, but they weren't members of the union when we reached the deal, and therefore the clauses are legal. How have labor boards responded to that defense? They've said, you know what? You're partly right. They may be legal when you entered into them, but when they take effect, that person is a member of the bargaining unit. When you're trying to go after money for that person who is left to go get a job someplace else, they're a member of the bargaining unit then, and therefore these clauses violate the obligation to bargain collectively in good faith, unless you have the union signing off on them. Now, that principle, this principle that these yellow dog contracts are illegal, I mean, that shows up in a lot of different settings. I've seen it in the last few years. You know, as police agencies have tried so desperately to recruit people, you see them offering hiring bonuses. Well, that's a mandatory subject of bargaining, right? That's wages. If the hiring bonus is paid after the individual is employed, then the agreement to have a hiring bonus has to be with the union. I've seen it with lateral transfer provisions where an employer will want to try to entice people who have prior experience, will say, look, I want to start them at step 3 of the wage schedule rather than step 1, whatever it might be. Is that a mandatory subject to bargaining? You bet. And it involves wages. And therefore, the agreement to do that has to be reached with the union. The employer can't do that unilaterally. So this is a principle, this principle against yellow dog contracts. It's one that has pretty rich reference in a lot of different settings in a labor relations environment. So that's rule 3. So rule 1 about these repayment of training costs, to reiterate, is generally speaking, they're legal. But rule 2, they can never take the employee down below the FLSA's minimum wage. And rule 3, if they are to exist in a bargaining environment, the agreements must involve the union and not just individual employees. So what's rule 4? Rule 4 comes to us courtesy of a recent decision involving the Los Angeles Police Department and a former officer by the name of Anthony Alvo. LAPD is one of these agencies that has lost a lot of individuals over the years, at least hundreds, maybe even more than hundreds, to other police agencies LAPD really faces this problem of coming on, getting some experience, and then employees leaving and going somewhere else. And in the early 1990s, the LAPD and the city of Los Angeles thought, we have to do something about it. And so what they did was to enact a new provision in the Los Angeles City Code, Administrative Code. And what this provision says is that if the individual voluntarily leaves LAPD after serving less than 5 years following graduation from the academy and goes to work for another law enforcement agency within 1 year after leaving LAPD, that they had to reimburse the city for training costs that were incurred. This case involves a former LAPD officer. This case goes all the way back to 2001. There's been a lot of litigation around this issue. A former officer by the name of Anthony Alvo. And Alvo left to go to another agency within the 5 year period of time, and the city sued him. And sued him for $34,000. That was what this administrative code provision would have allowed. And Alvo and a bunch of other employees who were also sued had all sorts of defenses. And finally, one issue raised by Alvo comes up to the California Court of Appeals. And that issue is this. What if the training is not training required to be a basic police officer in the state, but the training is additional training provided by the local agency? So here's what goes on. It goes on in Los Angeles, goes on in a lot of different places. And what goes on is that there's certain of the training that is focus just on whatever it takes to get what's called in California a post certificate, a basic post certificate. This is what you need to be a police officer anywhere. And then in addition to that basic post certification training, the city of Los Angeles in its academy provides all sorts of other training that is more specific to Los Angeles, what the rules are in Los Angeles, how they handle certain situations, the geography of LA, all that sort of stuff. So the question the Court of Appeals has to answer is there a difference in terms of state law as to the post-training, the post-mandated training, or the discretionary training that is provided by the Los Angeles Police Department? And the court's decision turns on a provision of the California Labor Code and the way it interweaves with some provisions of the Penal Code. And the bottom line, the court says, is that the post portion of the training can be subject to a repayment of training costs, but the LAPD-specific training cannot be. And here's the way the court analyzes it. The court says post-certification is deemed by the legislature in California to be a professional certificate. It's in effect a license to act as a police officer. And therefore, we think that the city can require a peace officer to bear the cost of this licensing through a repayment of training costs. However, the court says, if you have training that is not required by a state statute or public policy, but was rather instituted purely to satisfy the needs of the city, that's employer-mandated training, which the labor code will not allow the employer to transfer the costs of to the employee. And therefore, the only thing that the city can get reimbursed from Alvo is the post portion of the training costs. So, what we have then, when you put this all together, are these four rules, which I think generally are going to apply. Most states have labor code provisions, kind of like California's. The four rules are repayment of training cost provisions, generally legal, but they can't take the employee below the FLSA. In a bargaining environment, the agreements have to be with the union and not with individual employees. And lastly, they can only apply to that portion of training that is state mandated and not discretionary training, supplemental training, that the agency itself provides. I next want to turn to a decision coming out of the federal 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the area of the country. Usually you can think of it as Florida and the states immediately above Florida. And I picked this case to talk about because it's an illustration of what life is like sometimes in a non-union environment. This is a case that involves a deputy sheriff. Actually, she's more than a deputy sheriff, as you'll hear it in a moment, by the name of Terry Ezell. And she began working in the Muskogee County Sheriff's Office in 1983 as a corrections officer. And she had a pretty, I think it's safe to say, a path-breaking career. She was promoted to deputy sheriff within a couple of years. And by 2000, she became the first woman to have obtained the rank of major. And eventually she promoted even above that to become a commander, where she was third in command of the entire sheriff's office. Her job responsibilities as commander included supervising the jail and its 250 employees, as well as serving on the command staff of a sheriff, and the sheriff's name was Sheriff Johnson. In 2008, there was an election for sheriff. And a fellow by the name of John Darr ran against Sheriff Johnson. During the election process, Ezell showed some political support for Sheriff Johnson. She put a sign in her front yard, attended his campaign's kickoff event, spent time at his campaign headquarters, attended public debates, and she gave money to him. Well, he lost. And when he lost, and now Sheriff Darr took over, he began reorganizing the sheriff's office. And he basically fired virtually all of his command staff, either fired them or transferred them. He ended up transferring Ezell from being a commander to a position where she was in charge of something called the Recorder's Court, where she supervised only 12 employees, didn't even have access to a police radio. Darr then transfers the Recorder's Court out of the sheriff's office into the office of apparently the local city manager and ordered her to discontinue wearing her uniform. So she ends up going from this position of considerable authority and power to supervising 12 people without a radio and in plain clothes. At the same time, because he'd gotten rid of most of his command staff, Sheriff Darr makes a whole bunch of new promotions. And what he does is to promote 28 men and 6 women to the rank of sergeant and higher. No woman was promoted to a rank higher than lieutenant. As you might imagine, Ezell doesn't take kindly to any of this, and she brings a lawsuit in federal court. And she has essentially two claims. First of all, I'm being transferred, demoted, because of my political beliefs, because I supported the incumbent sheriff, and who was the opponent of Sheriff Darr, and it's very clear that the actions against me were because of my support for the new sheriff's opponent. Secondly, she claims I'm the victim of gender discrimination, and all of the people appointed to the new command staff were male, and several of us who were demoted were female, and that is at least enough evidence to get me to a jury on a claim of gender discrimination. The case goes to the Federal Court of Appeals in this area, and the court dismisses her lawsuit, says you have not made sufficient allegations even to get you to a jury. What about the First Amendment claim? What about the free speech claim that she had the right to support the candidate? The court said, well, she's at heart a deputy sheriff. And deputy sheriff, under the way we have interpreted the First Amendment, and by the way, other federal courts of appeals see it differently, deputy sheriffs are positions where political loyalty can be demanded. And if political loyalty can be demanded, a new sheriff can come in and wipe the slate clean and fire everybody just because the new sheriff doesn't like their political views. The way this court puts it is to say that we've looked at the duties of a sheriff, a deputy sheriff, and we have concluded that a deputy sheriff is, and I'm quoting, an agent of the sheriff and an agent for the purposes of effecting the proper discharge of the sheriff's duties, and is empowered with the same duties and authority as the sheriff. Can I pause for a moment? Really? Deputy sheriffs have the same duties and power as the sheriff? Anyway, that's what the court held. And the court then has to deal with the fact that, look, there can't be political loyalty involved in this position because we've got a civil service approach. And therefore, political loyalty can't be a requirement. And the court answers it this way. To the extent Ms. Zell argues that the civil service system has modified the legal relationship between the sheriff and his deputies, that argument misses the mark, even if it's true, because she cannot show how the civil service system modified the duties of a sheriff's deputies. We are bound to conclude that political loyalty is an appropriate requirement for the position of deputy sheriff in Georgia. And therefore, the court says, she can be fired. But what about the gender discrimination claim? What about the fact that the numbers here seem to really stack up in favor of Ezell, that most of the people who were promoted were men? All of them promoted above the rank of lieutenant were men, and a whole bunch of women were demoted. The court ends up saying, no problem. And the reason that there's no problem is because there were men who were demoted as well. Other members of the old sheriff's command staff were men, and therefore, we don't have a gender-based discriminatory decision. She can't point to the fact that only women were impacted. The way the court puts it is, no inference of pretext is available on the basis of the facts surrounding Ezell's transfer. Now, the court's a little troubled about it. Here's a quote from the end of the court's opinion. The court says, the general disparities in promotion and the rank of women and men in the sheriff's office under the new sheriff give us pause in reaching our decision today. They heighten our sensitivity to any evidence in the record that Ezell was treated differently than similarly situated men. But in this case, we end up concluding those disparities alone can't give rise to a reasonable inference that gender discrimination was at work. Why not? Because it was politics that was at work. It was the new sheriff coming in and cleaning house of the old sheriff's supporters, the old sheriff's command staff, and we've just held that's okay. And the result is Ezell loses her lawsuit. Well, this is part of a long string of cases involving what the courts refer to as political patronage. And it's the whole idea that if you have a highly placed individual, a policymaker, in a political agency, could be a city, could be a county, you have a policymaker, that the incoming elected official can surround themselves with policymakers of their own doing. And you see this applied all over the country, but usually only to very high ranks. I mean, you only see it applied to people at the rank, for example, of assistant chief or something like that. What's unusual about this court and its approach is that it says that everybody, right down to and including deputy sheriffs, are policymakers in Georgia and therefore can be fired for political reasons. I want to close with a case out of Ohio that answers a question that you don't see come up too often, but I think is really important in the minds of both employers and labor organizations. And that is this. If you've got a union leave provision where a union officer can be on company time doing union business, and while the officer is using union business, gets injured, is that a workers' compensation injury? This case comes out of the city of Elyria, Ohio, and involves Bradley Scott. Bradley Scott was an Elyria police officer. He's a union officer as well. And all of the what I'm about to talk about happened in August of 2004. Part of Scott's union duties were organizing, setting up for, and running what they call a steak fry. And as they're doing this, kind of a picnic, a storm approaches. Scott and another union member, this is a detective by the name of Lisa Dicha, left the site of the steak fry. Their intention was to go pick up some supplies for the steak fry, drop Scott's motorcycle at his residence, and get something to eat, and then come back to the steak fry location. However, on the way to Scott's residence, he was struck and killed by another motorist. Scott's widow files a death benefits claim under Ohio's workers' compensation system. The city opposes the death benefits, the award of death benefits. It goes to a hearing. Ohio's Bureau of Workers' Compensation awards the benefits, and the city appeals, and eventually the dispute gets up to the Ohio Court of Appeals. And the question is, was Scott, in the course and scope of his employment, when he was riding his motorcycle from place to place as part of his steak fry duties? That question, in turn, is resolved by what does it mean that something is in the course and scope of performance? And here's what the Ohio standard is, and it's pretty much the standard everywhere. Ohio standard is that an injury is compensable if it's sustained by an employee while engaging in an activity, and here I'm going to quote, that is consistent with the employment and logically related to the employer's business. So that's the overall standard. And courts trying to judge that will look at the time, place, and circumstances of the injury to see whether or not there's a nexus between the employee's activities and the employment. Now, Scott here, of course, was injured while performing duties as an officer of the union. He was running the steak fry. He was on paid union leave pursuant to the contract between the union and the city. And here's the way the court analyzes it. The courts, by the way, affirms the grant of benefits to Scott's estate. The court says, here, fulfilling the obligations of being a union officer and preparing for a union function were consistent with and logically related to Scott's employment. The collective bargaining agreement between the union and the city governed Scott's employment and his ability to function in a union capacity on city time. Here, the contract allowed for union delegates to perform union work while being paid by the city, and therefore the city clearly contemplated employees performing union functions such as Scott's while being paid by the city. In other words, the court concludes, reasonable minds can only come to one conclusion. Scott's injury arose out of the course of his employment. Now, the city has another argument here. The city argues that, look, it may have arose out of the course of employment, but it's not so clear that Scott was under our control at the time that the injury happened. And that's another element of the test. And the court rejects that argument from the city's part, on the city's part as well. The court says, look, Scott did leave the event site, and the city didn't control the location of the accident. And now I'm quoting, however, Scott intended to pick up supplies and return to the site of the steak fry at the time of the accident. The duties associated with running the event gave rise to the departure from the event location. The event itself benefited the employer by allowing officers to socialize with other officers and their families and boosted morale among city employees. The court ends up concluding, there's no issue of fact here. This is an on-the-job injury. Well, folks, that's it. That's our December first Thursday. I'm sorry I took up a little bit of time there with the rant about politics, but I do think it's an issue that really supersedes others in terms of employment. But now let me turn to a non-employment issue and wish you all a wonderful and safe holiday season. And look forward to seeing you next first Thursday in January of 2016. Get that, it's going to be 2016. And we, of course, look forward to seeing you in person at an LRIS seminar. This is Will Aitchison signing off.